Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopelessness, the meager food for soul for God. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
Sometimes you gotta play the chalk. So play the chalk. Welcome to Soma Time on an Eco Wednesday night. Yes, we have made it to the rain, Sapiens. Well, sort of. It's going to be some rain here tomorrow. Oh, wow. All right, well, that is that. So welcome to the program. Number to call to get into the mix is 646-478-4847. That's 646-478-4847. Shock me, surprise me, call me. I don't know what else to say. But, you know, this is one of those weeks where, you know, the show kind of wrote itself. There's so much going on. The cocoa is imminent. Give you a woo-woo cry for that.
Woo-woo! You know what I'm saying? Then you got the flows. They didn't trip off the flow, man.
That decoration, man.
That's right. We are converging this weekend, University of Bridgeport. Look out! They are coming from New Jersey and Vermont and New Hampshire, Massachusetts, even parts of Connecticut and New York, coming in from all different states. I think there's someone coming. No, Rhode Island. He's not going. But there's a lot of them. All of New England converging on Bridgeport for the first ever Coherence Conference. And I slapped it together, despite the weather, despite the doubters, despite the naysayers. I kept pinging and pinging away. And now we got a lineup I'm very impressed with. You go to the site, you can see for yourself. It's right there. Let me give you the lineup right now as I peruse. Because it's kind of a, you know, it's a little moment for me. Not that I ever do really, you know, amounts to much when it comes to you know, getting people to actually, like, show up. But we're going to have Dr. Irving Dornick from LifeWaves.com there. Rick Parr from Springfield College. Carlos Torre, psychologist extraordinaire from Yale University and Southern Connecticut University. And then we're going to have some other visitors. Alexander Riftine from the Nerve Express. Shocking heart rate variability research from him. And, wow, let's see. We got Mark Grossman coming here from VisionWorks USA. Mr. Magic Eye, have you ever done one of those stereograms? Remember that Seinfeld episode? You can give him the credit. Don Talion Jones is coming down to the afternoon session. Oh, baby. I can't wait for that one. And some other surprises. Maybe Fred Abraham will meander his way down after the storm, get on a canoe, come down here from Waterbury, Vermont, from the Blueberry Brain Institute. Famous Fred Abraham, brother of a famous Ralph Abraham, talking his math, talking his smack. On Sunday, we have Jared Murray from Venuing.com and my own eco brother-in-law, Anthony Burke from VML.com, a fancy, fancy site that does fancy coding things that I could never understand. They talk like a bunch of clicking Hottentots, techie bastards. But we have all kinds of stuff spread all over the site. If you go to the SummerSpace.org site and you click on the Coco link, you'll see we have videos up from Deb Roseman from HeartMath, Eric Luskowitz from the Joyous Socks. Soon you'll see one from Pete Egascu from the Egascu Method. That'll be up tomorrow night. Stephen Elliott from Coherence.com, the Coherence Breathing, and all his stuff. David Goodman from the Newport Neuroscience, who's been on the guest on the show several times. Lot to say on that one. You watch his video, and you lock the door. Then you watch Dan Winter's video, and you bolt it. Okay? I mean, these guys, they put their heart and soul in it. We just got one in from Susan Lacombe from MyShrink.com, and we have one that's going to be filmed tomorrow by Alexandra Crane from Eliza Corporation. She already has her written stuff up there, which is very provocative. I definitely encourage you guys to go to her site, her sister site that's called EngageWithGrace.com. It deals with end-of-life issues. Why are we doing this? Why, Gus? Why am I stabbing myself in the eyes for weeks? Because we're fighting the forces of nature that are out there in Health 2.0, and you know who they are.
You filthy criminals.
That's right. And what they've done, basically, in a short period of time, is they saw what was going to happen, and they sort of alamanded left right around Obamacare. And if you go to any Health 2.0 site or any kind of symposium, conference, or meeting, what are you going to see? Washington lobbyists, big pharma bastards, and insurance company representatives. Get the frig out of my Health 2.0! Supposed to be driven by us! Whatever happened to grassroots? Now we got AstroTurf in our Health 2.0. Nigeria, please. Will they ever go away? Like a pack of locusts they are. So they're waiting for you over there in Health 2.0. You know why? Because they just drove 31 million people into the waiting room. There's not enough people out there to take care of everybody, especially with allopathic symptom-chasing crap. That's the third leading cause of death. Death, I said. You just follow their advice, and you end up pushing up daisies, a crispy critter. Dupe them and dope them, as Affelter says. Robert Affelter just got his little surprise email. Chiropractic's another story. That whole profession is on fire. That whole profession needs one of these.
Guess what? I got a fever.
Huh?
And the only prescription is more cowbell.
That's right. Chiropractic has a fever. And what the fever is that they want to start sticking drugs in people and, you know, basically being medical doctors that'll roll your pelvis and rock your neck and gonna send you out the door. Lumbar roll and a cervical break. As I pay my homage to Herb Anderson, the big Swede chiropractor for 57 great years. You were lucky enough to be in his hands even for 5 minutes. You're still counting your lucky charms. Oh, it's kind of guru night for me. I don't know what to say. I'm very impressed by the friction that was created by contacting all these people to get involved with this, because coherence is a topic that I am trying to move from the very back of the tag cloud at Hell 2.0 right up to the front burner. Everyone that goes to Hell 2.0 blogs, sites, all these different platforms should be learning about how to take care of themselves through coherence practices, all kinds of things. You got your biofeedback, you got your meditation, you got your sleep-wake stuff, your little fuzzy eye and ear stuff. You got all kinds of ways to get coherence. But first, I want to give you a little preview. I'm going to fish it out of the bag here. I didn't think I was going to do this, but... Now, our guest tonight at 9:30 is basically, he's my Joe DiMaggio. He's my hero. I have to call Preber. Why is he my hero? Well, I'll give you a little story. Why not? I'm talking to myself anyway. You see? 9/11 on a Wednesday night.
Boozy, boozy, bop, city bop.
Leco alert. And anyway, it's been almost 20 years, but this little book called The Holographic Universe that you can see on the site, I tagged it on the preview there. One of those books you read when you first come out into the field as a greenhorn, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed chiropractor, got to go out there and just, you know, heal the world, right? So I come in contact with this book via the Richard Bartlett Express Train, matrixenergetics.com, if you want to go fish on that fryer. Anyway, Bartlett, guy haunts me. He really does. I see trucks with Bartlett's on it. It's amazing. He's always in the hologram. Anyway, in a good way. It's kind of a good haunting. It's a good ghost. He tells me to go get this book, and he says, I'm just going to warn you, it's going to blow your mind. I said, okay. So the book basically is Michael Talbot's journey through David Bohm's work in group psychology and dealing with how language functions as a system and how we have a proprioception of thought. Just the concept of having a proprioception of thought, a spatial awareness of our thoughts. How about that one? That's the first wave. Then the second wave is he gets this brain scientist called Preberm, who then was over at Stanford, and he's working with the holographic brain model, or holonomic brain, as he would correct me. And the combination of the two, you know, for me as a somasape, was like, wow, this is like, you know, a candy store on crack. And you read the book, and basically he takes you through a lot of the physics, a lot of the psychology, a lot of the emotional stuff that goes on as you come in contact with this holographic universe. So here we are 20 years later. I interviewed Carl last week. We're going to play it at the bottom of the hour. And it's amazing. It's almost a 45, 50-minute interview, so it's going to go almost to the end of the show. Amazing stuff. And bottom line is that once you understand that basic, that fundamental concept he's trying to get across, is that if you remove your lenses, your sensory apparatus, right, that allows you to trap light and sound and tactile sensations and flavors and all these things to create this experience, if you remove those filters, then you're just left with a holographic band of frequencies that are swimming around. So Carl prompted me to buy this article, Minding Quanta and Cosmology, that he wrote in the journal Zygon, which is reminds me of the Matrix, or about Zygon, back last year, right? So I'll read you the abstract, and then maybe when we come back or right before we play the interview, I'll give you a couple of quips. The abstract says, the revolution in science inaugurated by quantum physics, remember I get all over this dopey secret idea a lot because I think it's dopey, has made us aware of the role of observation in the construction of data. Not just that. Quantum physics, observer effect, you look at it and it's different, right? Okay. Eugene Wigner remarked that in quantum physics, we no longer have observables or invariants, only observations, because now we're aware that we're observing them, so we got to watch out. Tongue-in-cheek, this is Preberm, I asked him whether that meant Preberm, keep saying it wrong, that quantum physics is really psychology, expecting a gruff reply to my sassiness. Who in an abstract says sassiness? Instead, Wigner beamed, understanding, and replied, yes, Yes, that's exactly correct. David Bohm pointed out that if we were to look at the cosmos without the lenses of our telescopes, we'd see a hologram. The receptor process of the ear and skin work in a similar fashion. Without these lenses and lens-like operations, all of our perceptions would be entangled as in a hologram. You ever see a hologram? It looks like a bunch of little circles and stuff all interacting, and then you shine a light through it and you get a picture. Furthermore, the retina absorbs quanta of radiation, so that quantum physics uses the very perceptions that become formed by it. In turn, higher-order brain systems send signals to the sensory receptors so that what we perceive is often as much a result of earlier rather than just immediate experience. Well, if you listen to Benjamin Lippitt's stuff, this is in the abstract, but there's always a half-second delay on consciousness because that allows us to recognize if things are safe or not and process things and get what they call logical depth. That's another book, User Illusion by Tor Nordranters. This influence from inside out, and that's half of the chiropractic philosophy, above, down, inside out, becomes especially relevant to our interpretation of how we experience the contents and bounds of cosmology that come to us by way of radiation. Remember that word radiation? You know, it's the opposite of gravity. And then Dan Winter's video talks a lot about that if you want to check it out on the COCO site there. But basically what he's trying to tell us is that he wasn't kidding 20 years ago. It is a holographic universe, and now he can prove it. We're living in a freaking hologram. Oh, boy.
What the fuck was he talking about?
That's right. So anyway, Vance Pribham's article now, I like I said, there's a couple of funny quotes in here. Let me see if I can just find one that sticks out. Because he's very interested in like you said, the psychology behind quantum physics. Like how does knowing that everything is just a bunch of wiggly vibrations and we're observing them and making them real, how does that help us? And he says, we can eat brains, but not our experience. So our perception of matter is what he would call exformation, stuff that, like, you know, when you look at something and the color of it is what wasn't absorbed. So, like, we're living in sort of this sort of negative image of everything that our senses didn't filter out, and what's left over is the universe. That's a lot, because, you know, we can't perceive much at one time. But isn't that cool? That the only reason the universe exists, in the form that it does, is because we're perceiving things, and this gets into things like, you know, consensus reality and a whole bunch of other fun things, but we're perceiving things with our little melons here, and by doing that, we're giving it form. It's amazing. Talk about bending spoons. Unbelievable. So anyway, that's that article that Pribham wrote. And I just think it's, you know, it sort of lends itself to, like, the topic of coherence, which is basically about having a sense of coherence, right? So that you can then have a state of coherence and then go through a spectrum of coherence. And in my mind, it starts out with breathing and then moving and then feeling. Those are involuntary things. We all do constantly. And if we do them well, then we have a good rhythm there. And then if we can breathe, move, and feel well, then we act, relate, and express ourselves fully. Otherwise, we get inhibition, we get alienation, and we get, you know, self-righteousness and things like that. All those things that Trick and Barreau would call die-tentive behaviors. Splitting our attention between ourselves and our surroundings. Losing our sentience, not being as somatically aware. Losing our proprioception of thought. Love that. Let's see.
Have you ever transcended space and time?
Time, not space.
There you go.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
All right, along those lines, I think what I might do here, but there's a lead-in to Carl, is, let's see, I'll play a new video for you. Last week we played Rick Leskowitz's video. I think I'm going to play a little Rushkoff here. Douglas Rushkoff, who I've always admired, he's got a new book out. It's called Program or Be Programmed. You can go to rushkoff.com, pick that up for yourself. Amazing, amazing thinker. Very much understands the dichotomy between media and ourselves. And again, looking at cyberspace as another hologram within a hologram. Because you can't put a fork in cyberspace, can you? in there. So he's looking at it much more from a standpoint of how do you herd society? How do you get society to pay attention to you? Because it's a big thing, society. You can't get its full attention very easily. And he's got a very interesting take on coherence and how ideas get spread. So let's listen to him, and then we'll play the interview with Carl, and we'll come back with some closing thoughts as we wind it down here on a Cocoa Week Eve on a Wednesday night here in summertime. A little rush call for us, Maestro. And you can watch the video for yourself over on the summerspace.org link for it, /2010cocovideos.html. But just go to the Cocoa page and click through. All right, rush call time.
And a media theorist, so I'm a little far into the world of the conference, but not far into the idea of coherence. As I've been thinking about these issues, what comes to mind for me are the decade-long debates between an educator, Thomas Dewey, and Walter Lippmann, the original public relations propagandist who gave rise to Ed Bernays and the whole theory of propaganda. While Dewey argued for education, that the only way to have a democratic body politic would be for people to become educated and understand how to vote on issues, Lippmann believed that people were basically stupid and would rather be led by smarter people. So he thought all that really needed to be done was get a few benevolent elite in charge and then have public relations experts craft the messaging required to get people to vote how they were supposed to and to be happy about it. And it's not a completely cynical outlook, especially when you look at it in regards to health. As far as media is concerned, I've always been on the Dewey side, and I've always been concerned that people's intellectual, mental, and emotional coherence was being put at risk by advertising and public relations and other forms of mental coercion, because it seemed to me that most advertising was not really there to help people make rational decisions, but was actually there to stunt people's cognitive abilities, to put them in a state of panic or fear, and then step in as an authority figure and tell people what to do. You know, oh, you've got a pimple. Nothing can be done, so buy this product right now. Which didn't seem to me to be the right way for people to be going about their lives, making decisions in a state of imposed anxiety. And I saw new media, particularly the Internet, as a way for people to regain coherence, because now instead of just receiving the messages from elites, we could make messaging. And I wrote a lot about memes, Richard Dawkins' idea of the little units of ideas and how they can spread around on a person-to-person level, or how any person with a computer could launch an idea that ends up spreading through the entire media space. And it seemed to me that this was a way for us to regain coherence as a culture of individuals no longer being led around by propagandists and advertisers and other people who may not have our long-term they might not have the best intentions for us. Unfortunately, I found most people use computers and these technologies pretty much out of the box as they're supposed to without any real idea of how they work, and very reluctant to become meme launchers themselves. Rather than using these things for coherence, you know, we use Facebook to make friends, almost utterly unaware of the fact that Facebook is not really there to help us make friends, but is there to help monetize our relationships and come up with some business plan to market to us through these devices. And I wrote a book, I just finished one, called Program or Be Programmed, which follows some of the ideas, I guess, of general semantics, looking at new media and all the biases of new media and promoting the idea that people really need to know how these things work if they're going to work them effectively. That essentially, if you're not writing the software on some level, then you are the software. It's funny, though, as I think about myself as a health consumer, I realize that I'm much more on the Lippman side of things than the Dewey. You know, I would rather, on some level, just turn to a professional who tells me what the heck to do without me ever really understanding my body and how it works and what coherence is. I just want you to tell me how to be coherent rather than me understanding what coherence is. And if I'm thinking that way, I can't imagine how people who don't think about this kind of stuff think. I think they're even falling further on the side of really just tell me how to be. And the thing that the traditional medical field has over all of you guys is that they are willing to step in and say, we know, take this pill, it'll make you better, we've got the research, here's the stuff, you can't understand it, so don't even try, just take the pill we tell you to and shut up. And I know deep down that that's not the way to reach coherence or health. I know that health is ultimately dependent on coherence, on reconnecting mind and body, and on maintaining a sustainable approach to what I eat and how I live and how I move and how I contend with challenges. The problem for the Health 2.0 universe, I think, is that by even just admitting to people that they need to be coherent, it makes it sound to them perhaps like you're not as good authorities on these things as the people who stand up and say we're the authorities. That the very openness that you have to a genuinely holistic approach to health, to the maintenance of health and to disease prevention instead of crisis maintenance, actually opens up those margins for the public to doubt the efficacy of what you do. It's like once a little bit of coherence is required from me in order for what you're doing to work, then it's sliding down that slippery slope towards what I think of as placebo. And that's not a great position for you to be in, especially in a world where we're all so rushed and all just looking for the quick fix to whatever it is that hurts. I don't know that I have explicit advice for you. I do have my condolences, and I certainly consider myself a comrade. And what I'm arguing for in all of my work, really, is for understanding, is for literacy, is for people to step up to the plate and come to grips with the fact that nobody really has the answers, at least not in the form that we might want them, and that coming to terms with coherence as a personal and collective responsibility rather than something that could be bestowed upon us is not an unpleasant thing, but is actually a much more fruitful, engaged way of participating in the process of one's own life. So that's enough from me. Thanks a lot for what you do, and good luck in getting the world to understand that coherence and our very evolution are our team sports. Take care.
Okay, there he is, the Rushkoff. That's a somber message. Oh boy, I guess I'll squeeze in a little news before we give it a prebrim. So without further ado, our swine friend.
Oh, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, gun. You thought I was going to say son of a bitch, didn't you?
All right, here's a Dateline story, USA Today. Swine flu no longer, I repeat, no longer represents a major threat to the U.S. population because most people are immune to the virus that caused last season's pandemic.
health officials reported Tuesday. They're giving out these shots fucking right. Of the 310 million people in the United States, 59% are now believed to be immune to the pandemic H1N1. H1N1, I call it. The researchers say approximately 62 million people were vaccinated, 61 million were infected, and another 60 million people, 57 or over, carried protective antibodies against similar viruses dating back to previous pandemics. Wow, 60 million of them were already immune before they started. It's very likely the virus will explode in the fall. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, and author of the analysis, we now have evidence. Does anyone tell the clowns at the Center for Disease Control? Let's see the next paragraph. The evidence comes from studies on the 2009-2010 pandemic carried out by the CDC, Center for Disease Cheerleading. Come on, come after me. If this virus follows the pattern set by earlier flu bugs, it will either die out completely or continue to circulate in an ever-shrinking pool of people still susceptible to it. The authors report in the journal MBio. That doesn't mean the virus has totally lost its punch, says co-author David Morins, a virologist and historian, also the NIAID. Even with the majority of people in the U.S. still immune, it leaves tens of millions still susceptible. Run for your lives. This is a double message. We know the age groups that are most susceptible, people younger than 55 and those with chronic conditions. So now the elderly are fine. They're the ones that get bust off to get shot. For the first time, federal health officials recommend that all people older than 6 months get vaccinated against the flu, unless they have allergies to eggs, because the eggs are in the vaccine, or sensitivity to the flu vaccine. Yeah, because you don't want to be paralyzed or made into a narcoleptic. Five manufacturers are now churning out 150 million doses of a seasonal flu vaccine that contains the pandemic H1N1. This is their little cocktail that they're putting together. And more potent vaccines now available for older people. Pulmonologist at SUNY Stony Brook, Norman Edelman, said, president of the American Lung Association. Yeah. To reinforce the importance of vaccination, Edelman says he's offering his organization has launched its fifth annual Faces of Influenza campaign to demonstrate how severe the illness can be. They're not going to scare you. And then he says at the end, everyone can benefit from a flu shot. How? Did he read the beginning of the article? Hey, Edelman, blow me. All right, enough of him. Ugh, can't stand it anymore. Flu pandemic differences produce confusion. A WHO probe. Geneva, 6 hours ago. The head of the World Health Organization, worst health organization, probe into the international handling of the swine flu pandemic said Wednesday that multiple definitions of a pandemic cause confusion and muddle the response. The multiplicity has led to confusion and at least produced a very different understanding of what the meaning of the field reality is. Harvey Feinberg, chairman of the review committee of external experts formed in April, said. Feinberg said, after the third round of hearings by the panel in Vienna. Vienna waits for you, that it would consider recommendations seeking at the minimum clarity and consistency on the issue. However, he told journalists that a system with several definitions could be applied in different situations and might be warranted. The WHO, not Daughtry et al., but this dopey organization that's a political front for everything else, declared the first flu pandemic of the 21st century in June 2009 as the new AH1N1 influenza strain spreading swiftly around the world at about 6 weeks after it was first uncovered in the United States and Mexico. It triggered a rash of costly emergency measures to guard against infection and the rush on doctors in some countries, but public concern about the swine flu fizzled out later in the years and proved to be less severe than feared. They thought 90 million people were going to die! Jesus! A pandemic denotes global geographical spread, according to the WHO, but its flu alert system is also influenced by concerns about the potential severity of the virus, while some national definitions differ. Feinberg, who heads the Institute of Medicine and U.S. National Academy of Sciences, said after several months of gathering testimony from a wide range of normal people involved in the study, there are many gaps in detail still to be filled. Blow your nose and leave me alone. have a little vitamin D with that. The experts who will hold another public hearing in November, maybe get the egg off their face, are aiming to have a draft report ready for the WHO Director General in early January 2011 with a final version in May. All they have to do is write reports that says we're wrong, and they still go out and stick people. Tremendous. All right, quick little story here, and we'll get to Prebrum. Prebrum, tuning in late. We're going to have Carl Prebrum here talking brain with me. Jonathan Benson, staff writer for Natural News. Social media, that movie coming out on Friday, Social Network, looks good. Going to go catch that, ba-ba-ba, before the cocoa. Social media addiction can ruin your health. So forget about the flu, it's the computer. Constantly updating your Facebook status, tweeting your every move, and spying on your friends, relatives, and coworkers who are doing the same thing can increase stress levels, ruin sleep patterns, and degrade meaningful personal relationships, according to a new study of the Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, HUST. Social media can so, this is kind of what Rushkoff was saying, can so quickly become an addiction, say scientists, who are tweeting right now, that is literally ruining people's lives in terms of health and relationship. Researchers from HUST recently performed a social experiment in which they deprived the university's entire 800 student population from using social media for a week. It's like when they take TV away from kids. What they found was that social media addiction is similar to drug addiction and that people go through similar withdrawal symptoms. The majority of students behave like smokers who sneak cigarettes after class. They'd sneak off to check things on their smartphones, said Eric Dahr, provost of the college. Some students are so addicted to social networking sites like the Facebook that they spend upwards of 21 hours a day connected to the site in some way, whether on the computer or through their mobile phones, leaving only a couple hours for others to sleep. Many have no time whatsoever for quality face-to-face interaction with their friends and family as a result. Facebook is infecting our brains. No, it's not in the article. I just said it. But because of the experiment, many students came to an abrupt realization that social network addiction is destroying their health both physically and relationally. Some admitted that they need to make some radical changes in their daily habits. Students realized that social media, especially Facebook and instant messaging, if not properly managed, can take over their lives. Only by stopping and paying attention can we understand it. We may not even be aware that social media plays a big part in what we do and how we do it. So there you go. So if the swine flu won't get you, then the Facebook will. Bad, bad, bad world. It's a bad, bad world. I need something here. There's got to be a way to punctuate something like that. No, that's too loud. All right, a little Steinberg.
Anyway, as I was lying in the puddle, I think I may have found a way for us to get Bonds and Griffey, and we wouldn't have to give up that much.
Well, don't tell it to me, George. Tell it to the new assistant of the general manager.
I didn't get the job.
Well, once you were dead, we couldn't just sit on our hands. We got to make a move. What? You still have your old job. Of course, we'll have to dock you for the time you missed. We're running a ball club here. If I give special treatment to you, everyone will want it. Next thing you know, it's chaos. And I can tell you this, chaos does not work for the New York Yankees. Not as long as I'm running the show.
All right, there you go. A little pre-internet fun there with the boys from Seinfeld. All right, so without further ado, I'm going to leave the yapping fest here to give you a very special treat. This is the interview I did with Carl Prebrum last Thursday. You can always find it on the SummerSpace.org site. If you click on the Coco link and then go down to Coco Audios, his interview is there along with the one we played last week with Tom Myers. Great interview we did with him. So without further ado, I will leave you to the good hands of Carl Prebrum and myself as we take a little journey in the holographic universe. I'll be back to close up shop after it's over. All right, we've been on the air for about 3.5 years, and we've been talking about him, mentioning him, sometimes genuflecting towards Georgetown, but here with us now, without further ado, and I'm going to get one mystery out of the way right away. His name is Carl Prebrum. Now, my name is Mark Filippi. Both of us have probably suffered many mispronunciations of our names over the years, so and you've probably suffered them with your ears burning more than mine, but welcome, finally, to Summertime, Dr. Prebrum.
Hello.
There he is. Okay, so I guess what I want to start with is just to take it back a little bit. Back in the 60s,
everybody wanted to talk about energy. Everyone wanted to talk about different forms of energy. Whatever industry you were in, that was becoming the vogue thing. That morphed into psychology in the 70s. Then you put science on it in the 80s, neuroscience, cognitive science. Then in the 90s, everything became medicine if you wanted to get backing. And I'm talking more about how you move an idea along. And then this decade, the one that just passed, even though the 90s was the decade of the brain, if you put brain after it, people paid attention, whether you were talking about gender differences or the enteric or the gut brain, and then, of course, all the work with heart math and the heart brain, Bruce Lipton's work with membrane, all the developmental aspects, especially when you're dealing with the spectrum, autism, Alzheimer's, social brain, the work with that, and the global brain online. As someone who's been around for the entire journey, do you see us using that term brain the way you would in a descriptive way, or do you see it being used more, for lack of a better word, as a marketing tool, just to kind of start us off here?
I think both. I think that finally what we've been working for the last three-quarters of a century is to get psychology and brain science together. And that's going strong and it's doing very well. But also, there's some things that are wrong that are being done, or not wrong, but at least not very good. And there's a lot of marketing going on.
Mm. And I guess because you've been someone who's always been able to take risks and sort of get away with it, as it were. I remember watching.
That's true. I'll agree to that.
Yeah, I mean, I watched a couple of videos of you, you know, where you talk about having triple tenure at 40 and being able to do whatever you wanted. Well, it's nice. It must be nice. But for the rest of us out here, especially when we're talking about all the innovations that have gone on in the last maybe 20 years, I guess since perception of the brain's kept coming up on its 20-year anniversary now, what is the one thing you've seen that's been a risk-reward in terms of neuroscience? What is it that we risk learning about the brain that gave us the most kind of bang for our buck, so to speak, where we put the money in the right place research-wise and we actually made some headway here?
That sounds like a good marketing ploy. I have no idea. In other words, I've been working at this for three-quarters of a century, and there's a lot of good stuff, and I've suggested some things, some of them like inaugurating the cognitive revolution in psychology, and so on have taken, the limbic system stuff has taken, and some of it has not. The holographic stuff is still, it's coming into its own, but it's taken a long time.
Yeah, I can appreciate that with you, because going back, I have a quote here from Languages of the Brain from 71, and just see from page 25 of that book, from the States and Operators chapter, that is so dog-eared, when I picked it up last night, the damn book almost fell apart in my hands. But it says, the unit of analysis of brain function has classically been the neuron. The present proposal for a two-process mechanism recognizes an individual unit, the neural junction, whose activity can become part of an organization, the slow potential microstructure, temporarily unrelated to the receptive field of any single neuron. Neural junctions are thus more than just way stations in the transmission of nerve impulses. They compose, at any moment, a neural state that is operated upon by arriving nerve impulses. In turn, nerve impulses generated by neurons are influenced by this state. Looking back almost 40 years later, do you want to amend what you said? Do you want to reinforce what you said? How does that statement stand up over time?
Stands up very well. And there's another book called Brain and Perception, and that fills out what happened, and that's 1991, 20 years later, and takes that a step further.
Yeah, and in that book, this is when, and now 20 years later, as you say, talk about where the money went in the intervening 20 years, where we got into cognitive neuroscience, and we got into systems theory, and we got into the the whole notion of, and led into things like neuroplasticity and some of the things you still see buzzing around now. The one thing that I take out of it, having come in right in the middle of that in the late 80s in there, was this notion of non-synaptic transmission, aphaptic transmission, and this and the discovery, really, on an anatomical level, more teasing it out, of the perineural system. And how that, the perineural system is sort of a, it's akin to what's going on with some of the things that James Oshman's uncovered with tensegrity matrix and looking at the whole, everything around the nervous system. It's not, you know, the wiring that supports it, whether it's, things like that. So,
well,
so
that's what I said, that those are the states. And they are what's going on in the fine-fibered dendrites and telodendrons of the nervous system. And those are oscillations of hyperpolarization and depolarization. And they are not part of the circuit. The circuit addresses that state function in the fine fibers, and that's chemical and aphaptic, as you say, tight junctions. There are all kinds of things going on, and they're not just at the synapse. They are in between the synapses as part of what's going on in the fine fiber system, the dendrites and their surrounding glia, the orbital glia.
Now, this is something, again, just to get Perry conversational with you for a minute, is that in the Health 2.0 conversation that's going on right now, which is largely being dominated by Big Pharma and the insurance industry and all the changes that are going on that actually kick in today, being the 23rd, some of the first laws kicking in for the healthcare reform, quietly in the corner here, in our little conversation here at the Coherence Conference, you know, you're with the hand on the elephant kind of syndrome that takes place. Everyone has a different way of sort of contextualizing coherence and then applying it. And that big elephant that's riding through, in my mind, always had you on top of it. But then you emailed me a couple of days ago and said, you know, I get associated with this word a lot, but really I talk more about coordination. And I guess that's akin to talking about superimposition. Could you make a distinction between what others have said about you in terms of coherence and what you say about what coordination is in terms of brain function?
Okay. Well, let me, first let's take coherence.
Okay.
Because that's what your conference is about. And the people at HeartMath are doing a lot of good stuff on coherence. And according to that kind of stuff, it is a balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic.
Okay. So you look at it more as a result, as an outcome. That coherence is produced by those twin conversations, and
that's
then if they're in sync, you have coherence. Okay.
All of this is not all that new, because in the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century in Vienna, people were dealing with parasympathetic and sympathetic balance in their own way. I think it's more sophisticated what's been going on at HeartMath, and it's a much more subtle kind of. But I wanted to be sure that you distinguish that from meditation or from hypnosis. They are three very different states that people get into.
And so in terms of coordination and a holonomic sense, are you talking more about...
Wait a minute. You get,
okay.
I'm talking about
coherence, you mean?
Coherence, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't get into
coordination.
It's a different topic.
Yeah, I'm trying to get you off the elephant and make the distinction, because most people, when they associate you with coherence, they associate you with the work of Gabor and the structure of a hologram, reference beam, object beam, lasers, you know, as opposed to incoherent light that's more diffuse, and the nervous system being modeled after that. That's really where they get that association.
Well, that is my thing, and I'm very pleased with the way it's going, and what evidence we're getting, and so on. So, but those are different topics. That's one topic. Coordination is another topic. Coherence is still another topic. And you don't want to get them all mixed up.
Yeah, they're easy to overlap because, again, if we're just talking about just not so much on a structural level, because we're going to build the hologram here in a minute with you, because, and we're talking about Carl Pribram, if you guys haven't recognized the voice. I flipped through Brain and Perception last night just to kind of see where you went from 20 years ago and then 40 years ago. A lot of the stuff that was happening in the first book in Languages of the Brain was more modeling based on you know, pre-computer stuff and things that you had to estimate, things that you had to use kind of rudimentary cybernetic models. In the 20
now,
years
hold on.
Since that.
Mistakes.
No mistakes.
The computer model. We wrote a book called Plans and Structural Behavior,
right,
which was published in 1960.
Right. This is a tote model and all those things. Those are cybernetic in nature, no?
Yeah, and
okay.
That, in Languages of the Brain, I brought that up to date with parallel processing, which we didn't have in 1960. We got into neural nets and things of that kind, and Languages of the Brain was the beginning of that whole story. So it's not throwing away the computer model. It is actually the other big thing that's happened in computers, which is neural nets and parallel processing.
Right. And by the time you wrote the Languages book, we still weren't at the point where the computers can do all the processing and do all the prediction and get very specific, and the computational aspects of them were limited, which then led to things like chaos theory and things like that we could actually make much more complex models of the brain using computers. And now, 20 years later, we've sort of, I don't want to say transcended that model, but we've gotten a little more organic again, and we've gotten much more into the environmental influence on the brain. And one of the phrases, I guess, that kind of sticks with me, being raised Catholic and a chiropractor, I guess, is the notion that the motor cortex is a sensory cortex for action. That's one thing that you said that just stuck with me for, I don't know, how many years
that's
now.
That's a good one, yes. And that's one of the contributions which has not been totally taken care of. The fact that the motor cortex is a sensory cortex that deals with targets, images of achievement.
Right.
That's another very important topic. And one that I wish the neuroscience community would accept wholeheartedly.
It's one of the ones that's always kind of made me stand still and sort of remember almost, because we're so focused on the division or on the coupling of sensory motor. But when you say that it's a sensory cortex for action, and then you get into the notion of holo movement and all the other things that come up with that in terms of the way the brain organizes information, because one of the other things that people, I don't know if they brush over it or they're just kind of like it's too dense to really understand, is that a lot of your research is on the cortex talking to itself on associative stuff and being able to weigh information and sort of, like you said, select things and then run its top-down mechanisms. What is it that we're so, I don't want to say intimidated, or we're so overwhelmed about cortical design and cortical just the structure of it that makes it so elusive to kind of pull down to the ground and apply it down here?
Well, the main problem is that we are still stuck on the reflex arc notion.
Uh-huh.
And in the 1950s, we got above that, and we got to feedback loops and thermostat-like homeostats, even for the sensory systems. And then 10 years later, we got the feed forward. So that is what is involved here, is this gradual understanding, and not only the idea, but the data that back it up. So that is what went on during 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. Now, if you try to put that into a textbook, which I have, and written it up, and the editors loved it, that we have feed backs and feed forwards. You put it in a textbook of psychology, you know what happens? The publishers take it out and put the reflex arc back.
Wow. So it's that entrenched in the collective conversation of the culture that if you don't use that as your basis to build a model or an idea, it doesn't sort of stick in the outside world. Even though science basically has, sort of moved on from that and gone on to things that you're talking about, where we're getting into now. I guess I just spoke with Tom Myers yesterday that the nervous system, among other systems, and you have fascial systems, and we mentioned the perineural system, all of these graded potential conversations that are going on around the action potential conversations is really what we're trying to rub these two sticks together to get this hologram. So why don't you build the hologram for us, if people haven't really kind of digested this model, if we're going to throw Sherrington and all his stuff, into the timber and watch the fire go up, what are we left with to understand how the brain constructs this or is designed to construct this hologram?
Well, the holographic aspect has to do with fine fibers and what's going on, the oscillations between excitatory and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. And that's very nice, very well. Now, I'll tell you something before we're all done. I have a book coming out.
Uh-oh, a third book. Okay, well, maybe it's a fourth.
Well, there are others. There was the Freud book and a few others.
Right.
But, yes, I've got a book coming out which really tries to explain all of this in, I would say, almost lay terms. It's meant to be an accessible book. And hopefully within a year you'll be able to read about all of this and how it can be phrased. And there's a lot more to all it than one can talk about in half an hour, obviously. And
you got a working title for this yet?
Yes.
Okay. What's it called?
You're not allowed to have it.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I think maybe Brain might be in it. We might go there if we can reveal that much today.
Catherine won't let me do any of this, which is very different from the way I've always done things. But she's very... she says that, and this is true, I've had titles that I've submitted and people have stolen them and so on. So,
And in case, just as people might want to check the Wikipedia page on you, Catherine Neville is your significant other, so, well-known author, so she's training you well to keep things under wraps.
She certainly is, and she's putting a website up for me with references to the 700 publications we have and things of that kind. So that
wow.
All is in the works, and we had a deadline sometime around June 15th. Of course, we haven't met it. We're still working on it. Things went wrong, as they always do on all of these things. But the thing is, should be getting going very actually out there pretty soon.
You got us on our tiptoes waiting for next summer when this thing comes out, I guess, is when we're looking at it, right? Around that would be when you'd expect it to be released?
I don't know.
You're hopeful.
If I knew all that, I would let you know.
Okay. You call me first at home when you know it's going to happen. I guess the one thing I want to get on here, we're going to go back to what you were saying here in a minute, but the one thing, I guess, in the last 5, maybe 8 years that's come out in brain research is this notion of the 40 hertz binding frequency and all that's come up around it. Again, it does lead into a lot of your holonomic model on a neurological level.
Not really.
I agree with you, not really. What is it that you make of it in terms of, you know, because Linus's research is very well documented. Are they building this thing? Again, if you haven't heard about the 40 hertz frequency, it's supposedly the one that keeps, you know, us in a lucid, awareness of our all the states, and it integrates thalamic function and cortical function. And what is it about that literature or that whole direction that makes you and me go, I don't know.
Well, the first thing is the 40 hertz data done with microelectrodes intracerebrally is very good and solid.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff on the EEG side is not. It's not easy to do the 40 hertz because 60 cycles are around in all of our lighting. Everything is getting in the way. And to get 40 hertz in the EEG is not an easy thing. And I've, for that reason, in my stuff, I've not really done much with it.
So, again, building this hologram, are you happy, or are you going to put your chips in the middle of the table on what you put out there about it and looking at it from the standpoint of the top-down processing and the association cortex and the hologram actually being built almost superimposed in the brain, the brain basically being that Fourier transform that can take, you know, what would perceive to be an ocean of frequencies, and then you filter it through the brain and you get what is selected.
Yeah, well, we've been able to talk about all of this in a more and more sophisticated way because, as with quantum physics and
mm-hmm.
things like that, it's taken a long time to get the language right. But the fact that fine-fibered systems work in terms of oscillations and that these oscillations can be modeled mathematically with the Fourier transform, and Fourier's contribution was that we're dealing with spectrum,
right,
not waveforms, something that David Bohm used to kick my butt about. I'd slip back and talk about the problem between waves and particles. That's not the problem. That's in space and time. In the spectral domain, which is the holographic domain, you're dealing with the intersection between different waveforms with the spectrum. In other words, if you drop a pebble in a pond, you get waves. Another pebble, waves. Where those pebbles intersect, you get the spectrum. You get something different.
Well, you get interference patterns, and then interference patterns then give rise to your own.
It's already in languages of the brain, but we have better ways of talking about it now and easier, and I can demonstrate it more easily, which I did just yesterday evening to my class at Georgetown. So it's very much, I would say, it's been a long haul, but I think more and more people are going to be, more and more of the technical people in the neuroscience are going to be able to handle it. There's no problem in engineering. I presented my stuff about 3 or 4 years ago, and Emmett Leith, who really built the first palpable hologram with laser beams and all that, he heard my talk, and he was absolutely supportive. You know, I said, that's exactly right. So people in optics, people in engineering, so have always been understanding of what this is all about. But neuroscience has failed, and it's failed in one sense. It's all about circuits.
Mm-hmm.
And the dendritic stuff, it's there if you look for it, but people aren't comfortable, neuroscientists, with that stuff. The chemists are. And
sure. I mean, again, this is, like you say, we started talking about, you know, your two-process model, that all those graded potentials that gives the action potentials a terrain to work off of.
Of course. You've got it.
Thank God I got it, Carl. I mean,
you got it years ago.
Yes. And you told me, you warned me. I was a little greenhorn chiropractor in the early 90s, and you said to me, be patient because the technology has to catch up with the insight you're getting from this, and the intellect will just kind of stand there. And I kind of feel like maybe the intellect kind of slowed down, got out of the car and checked the map, and the technology passed us by, and it was all sexy and nice, and everyone went and followed the bus. You know? And now we're chasing a bunch of blinking lights, and everybody's, you know, just so enamored with the digital world and so enamored with that, you know, very, you know, almost like you say, this axonic sort of euphoria we get because HDTV and everything being crystal clear, and there's no stochastic resonance, there's no noise anymore to give rise and give it depth. And, you know, one of the reasons why, and maybe you've seen this more than others, as the technology's kind of taken over the culture, we become more visually based.
Yeah,
or kinesthetically damp, we're not aware kinesthetically.
Two things to be said there. I listen to the music that's digitized, and we go back to our old analog records, and it
mm-hmm.
sounds so much richer.
Yeah, that's the thing. They're going back now, and they're remastering. This is how funny it gets. They're going back and remastering some of those vinyl recordings. So the scratchiness is there, just like they give you jeans that have holes in them when you buy them. You don't understand, you know, it's a shortcut that doesn't work. I liked putting holes in my jeans growing up. You know, I liked doing that, and it was part of the fun of wearing them.
Now, the other thing is that Fourier transform, since it
mm-hmm.
deals with the spectrum, with the intersection, with the... with the intersection between waves, it's digital. It isn't waves. You're getting
right.
numbers. The Fourier series is made up of numbers, and they're digital. So it isn't digital versus analog, but it is
mm-hmm.
a matter of, if you're dealing with the spectrum, that you're dealing with something much richer than you do if it's just the digital stuff.
Well, if it's just flat analysis, what happens is that what I see happening is that they try to flatten these things out
exactly.
and make them in a two-dimensional plot when it's actually, you know, like you say, it has much more nooks and crannies to it. I always think of that Mexican hat in the old book as sort of my somatic terrain that I'm traveling through on this cognitive map that I made of it, and here I go out the door. I kind of wish Michael Talbot was around to write his sequel to his book. I'm looking forward to your book, definitely. But, you know, when Holographic Universe came out, you know, early 90s, right around the time Brain and Perception came out, right around when David Bohm was coming out with Thought as a System and all that, do you think 20 years later, if Michael was around, he would write the holographic multiverse now? And because of all these insights about the nature of the cosmos as a result of people sort of somewhat digesting a little bit of the holographic model?
Let me tell you, I have a paper that was published a year ago last summer
mm-hmm.
in Zygon, a journal of religion and science.
Okay.
That gives you the whole picture of what I believe is going on in physics. and takes off from David Bohm. And you might take a look at that. It's in June issue of Zygon, Z-Y-G-O-N. I had a paper in Zygon back in 1960 or 70, I guess it was 1970 already. They're very good philosophical journal, and really try to get some of this stuff together. So take a look at this paper, because it's probably the most far-out paper I've ever written. And take
they're saying a lot, though. Wait a minute. Okay. I'm going to back up here. If you're going to surprise me, then I'm going to need to step back from the monitor here. I guess to kind of take a grand tour of this, and we've been talking with Carl Prebrim, if you look at coherence from your vantage point in the middle of the scientific community, where you could talk to any number of people who are going to define it in a qualitative way and a quantitative way, and you made a good distinction between that and coordination.
I haven't even discussed coordination.
Yeah, I'm saying we made sure that you were not stuck on coherence, that you've written more about coordination. So let's go back, circle back, and give you 90 seconds or so to go. What is it about coordination that makes it distinct from coherence?
Oh, it's a totally different thing. What is going on in the, large part of what's going on is correlation. They correlate brain function with certain behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is doing it very systematically, in the sense that they make maps of the brain and maps of the cognitive functions and try to see what's going on. But there are correlations. Now, correlation has a lot of problems. As David Hume, 200 years ago, pointed out, the cock crows, the sun rises. Does that mean that the cock crowing is making the sun rise? No. It happens to be the other way around. The correlation is that the sun rises and the cock crows. Is that the whole picture? The answer is of course not, because with the Copernican Revolution, we found out that the sun doesn't rise. Actually, the Earth is turning around in its own axis, and it's turning around the sun and so on. So you have a much more complex situation that you have to account for, which just doesn't really get going with the correlation. And everything that's been going on today in the brain and behavioral and spiritual sciences is correlation. Now, there is something that can be done about and has been done about it in language and other complex systems. Aristotle had not only efficient causation, but he had also final causation, and he had another thing, it's called formal or formative causation. And I suggested in Language of the Brain already, and have worked it out much more fully now, is that the way you get around that is coordination. And that means exactly what it says, coordinate. Holonomy is a term that Hertz coined for coordination. You take two ordinates, two orders, and put them together. And the Descartes coordinate systems are the most famous. He was the first one to do this. And all of the stuff where everybody's so much against Descartes, he was much wiser than anybody today. Who's criticizing it is. So he developed a coordinate system that the ordinates of two different ways of looking at things You put them together and see what's going on. That's coordination.
And again, this is something that kind of you mention in your writings, where you deal with the notion of something that's chronos, that's more temporal in the brain, is something that's more kairos, a moment of decision, where, again, the weighted variables, the conversation within the cortex will say now, and now doesn't take place in time. It takes place within the sphere of that interaction, and you get the holonomic sort of like, you know, or that sort of Eucharistic kind of, I get it, kind of aha feeling, where that doesn't happen anywhere on one dimension or one perspective, but if you take a different street, so to speak, all of a sudden everything's lit up for you. And that organization is the way the brain is, as you know, Dr. Muse and I joke around, the interdigitation, I can never say the word right, the interdigitation of the brain, the way it can cross over and reference itself and do all that very quickly by design. And because we have such a loose model of the infrastructure of the brain, like I said, we don't talk about anything but the circuits. And you mentioned top of the interview about glial cells and all these other things, all these other perineural things that are in there, using that spatial part of the brain to have the temporal conversation make sense to couple things. Amazing stuff. And that's just the brain.
Now you're again slipping back.
Oh, yeah, I know you're going to get me on that. I thought the fingernails.
Wait a minute.
I'll let you beat me up on that one. I know, I did space and time. Sorry.
Not space and time. It's spectrum.
Spectrum, yeah. And you know, looking at it from the data, I've been doing this for about as long as HeartMath's been doing it, looking at the power spectrums and different ways of looking at that data outside of FFT, outside of fast Fourier transforms, and looking at things like recurrence plot analysis and some of the things that look at it more on a nonlinear level.
Right.
What can you say about that direction of research? Do you see that becoming part of the culture's conversation, because we're living much more in a nonlinear world now on a cultural level?
My book is one of the big themes in it is nonlinear dynamics, chaotic theory, or complexity theory, and so on. I've done a lot
wow.
of stuff with that. And in fact, it's very interesting. They gave me an honorary PhD some 10 years ago or so in Bremen. Group was doing nonlinear dynamics, and I was at that time just struggling with the whole concept, but I now have found a way to actually do some experiments which are published on taking the EEG and showing how complexity arises out of the EEG, and it's very firm data. So I do a lot with complexity theory.
Yeah, and again, that's where I kind of came into the dance, was because I got the fractal bug and in dealing with the body, looking at the body systems in a fractal design. You get outside of the clean, crisp, three-dimensional world, and you get into the granular layer where, and then memetics went there too in the last 5 or 10 years. Memetics got into that, the nonlinear distribution of ideas and cultures rising up and how consciousness actually is shaped by that. There's so much, like I said, you must sit still sometimes and just laugh. And you know, we've been talking with Carl Brimmer, and he's been beat me up a little bit, which is fine. I never have a conversation with you where I don't learn a thousand things that I should unlearn. And I guess what it is looking at this group we put together, and we've got a lot of people here that have applied a lot of pieces of your model and taken things. What is the one thing, in summarizing here, that you would want us as a community that quote-unquote gets it to deliver out to the respective fields that maybe hasn't been clearly the baton hasn't clearly been passed? Is it just that spectrum thing we talked about, or is it something a little more subtle?
There isn't one thing.
Oh, okay. We have a list. Okay.
Yeah, I think that the brain's too complex for it to be one thing. And our being is more complex than just one thing. And so I think I just wished I could have come to be with you guys, but I really couldn't do it. So anyway, I think everything we've talked about, you know, we've ranged over a lot of stuff just in these in this last half hour or so, and that tells you what everybody ought to be paying attention to. They should certainly pay attention to the holonomic theory, which is not quite holographic, but it's almost so. It's constrained holograms, Gabor kinds of function, wavelets and all that. So that's one thing. I think another thing is the sensory motor stuff, that not only what we discussed, that the cortex is, motor cortex is a sensory cortex that deals with targets, with images of achievement. But the other way around, in order to get a good object perception, you have to have a motor system which almost overlaps, it's certainly next door, to the input, sensory input system. So there is no nothing like a sensory motor or perception motor circuit at all. The two motor systems and the sensory system overlap. It is the motor becomes sensory, the sensory becomes motor right away. And I'm not expressing this quite as nicely as it should be, but it's not a perceptual motor circuit at all. It's the two are, how can I put it, one interdigitates with the other.
I was thinking in my head he's going to say it, and you said it. That's like playing like liar's poker or something with you. Wow. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, one of the things that came up a lot in our discussions with the Snowflake community that deals with our little subgroup that kind of broke off with Fred Abraham and Bob Porter and others, and you know, by proxy, Ralph Abraham and some others, talking about that when you look at a systems theory with order parameters and control parameters, at a certain point they flip roles.
Yes, and, exactly.
And that Mobius nature of things is what's been missing because of the fact that we first divide, then we conquer in science, when we should be basically, as you say, interdigitating them and realizing that the roles are reversed based on context and get out of the content business and the labeling business and that static way of trying to sort of isolate things and frozen in time and say that's the way it is all the time in all circumstances when, as we know, conditions may vary, your mileage may differ, and, lather, rinse, repeat, because you're supposed to have a tentative grip on this thing, and I hope Krasinski heard me there, so that we don't get stuck in a map that takes us off the territory. With the map and the territory are one, so to speak, and they should be having a constant conversation. Maybe next year we'll call it the coordination conference, and you can bring your book, and we can sit there and clear a lot of this up and get a lot of this noise out of our heads so that we're not going to do it another generation because, you know, we'll sit down in 2031 and maybe we'll have it all figured out in another 20 years. But
well, unfortunately, all the things that I criticized in 1954 about the 19th century and phrenology, all those mistakes that I called attention to in my paper on toward my science of neuropsychology, all those mistakes are being made all over again. All this stuff.
I see a lot of the layers of it being out here in the somatic perspective where you're trying to actually kind of let it be more a felt sense awareness, the nonverbal aspect of it being much more salient, I guess, and getting out of the linear cause and effect models that we've been
you know, sort of a wash in, and they are doing it again. I hope they don't screw up epigenetics. I hope they don't screw up memetics with it. Darwin's been gone a while. I think maybe we can let him lie low and you know, stop trying to throw a lot of dirt on things like this. And I guess if you can close up shop here for us, what is the one thing that we've spoken about that maybe about your model in general, that's a misconception that because of the limits of language, it's hard to clear up, that maybe you can try to use some words here to clarify for us? Because there's so many things, there's so many, I don't want to say splitting hairs, but there's so many aspects of this topic that one word, like you said, spectrum versus space, you're off to the races. It's a very sensitive model when you're discussing it, or whether you're researching it, or when you're explaining it. So what is it that we can do to kind of keep our hands on the steering wheel here?
Well, do what the anthropologists and linguists in France did a century ago and say, efficient causality is not, you can't use it to understand complex systems. Language, you can't talk about language and as a concatenation of what I am saying now. That's not, you can't just run through it, and that's what people who use efficient causation are constantly doing. And a complex system won't allow that. You've got to do what Chomsky and Roman Jakobson did with language. You've got a very complex system, and you've got to take a look at the complexity of it and develop some techniques such as coordination, which you can use to look at the complexity. And nonlinear dynamics is another one. Those are techniques that you can apply to looking at this. And they're not easy.
No. Because of the fact that they're Mobius in nature, I mean, this is one of the things I'll throw back at you. Maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't, but the first American psychoanalyst, his name was Trigon Barrow, early researcher in biofeedback, he came up with the term cotension as an integrated form of attention, where most of us live in a split or a ditension model where we are dividing ourselves between symbols and feelings. And that causes us to feel separate and uncoupled from our surroundings and creates a lot of things that would basically break down this neuroception that you're talking about. So cotension, very akin to coordination, which gets into the contemplative stuff we talked about before, and all of that happens in a parallel universe to coherence.
Right.
Oh, my God. I'm afraid to look out the window. This is
yeah,
wow.
Back to the real world. It's true, though. That sounds interesting to me. Co-tension, right?
Yeah, co-tension. I'll send you some information about it. These are essays that were written between 1925 and 1950, looking at the eye as an organ of vision, that information traveling both ways, and amazing stuff. That you know, I'm going to be developing with my somatic tools here going forward, and I want to really from the bottom of my heart thank you for joining us on this interview, because you've given us, as usual, a buffet of ideas to feast on here as we go through the conference, and we will continue this conversation going forward, and hopefully you know next summer and into next fall we get you back out here and maybe get you up here in the Northeast to sit at the table and join us and really enjoy it, because if anyone needs to take a bow, I mean, I don't know if when you go in a room, you know, Bruce Springsteen can walk in any bar and everyone yells, Bruce! I don't know if you walk into a conference and they go, Carl, but they really should, because you are the boss. And
they do very often.
Oh, okay, good. As long as you're getting your propers. So, all right, you stay put, and everybody else just hang on for a second. We'll be right back with more Somatone.
All right, very good.
All right, there you have it. Me and Carl Prebrams swapping stories in summer space. Can you deal? That was amazing. And listen back to it. You can go over to the summerspace.org site, click on the Coco, click on the Coco Audios, and you'll see Carl's video is there all encapsulated and streamed for you. I really recommend you take a look at this guy's work, because it's like when he's long gone, I mean, people are going to be trying to figure out what this guy pulled down from the cloud. So, Carl Friedman, wow. All right, guys, so I'm going to wrap it up for tonight, and get ready for the Coco this weekend. You guys, if we still have some seats left over, if you guys want to come up and spend a half a day with us or Sunday morning with us or hang out with us after the conference on Saturday when we go out for a little Italian dinner, you can meet everybody, all the superstars that will be attending. And even if you can't make it to the conference, go over there and sign up on somerspace.org. Just click on the link, and we'll keep you in the loop, keep you aware of all the things that we're doing this fall as we launch Coherence Care on somerspace.org and all kinds of things. We're going to have coherence calls and coherence classes and coherence courses. I am going to stuff this word into your eardrums until you're out there singing the coherence anthem out there. All right, so I think I'll close up shop with an oldie but a goodie here, kind of a little song about what's just over the horizon. So we head down the pike to Bridgeport. I will see you here next week for a little post-Coco celebration. We get into a little baseball playoffs, a little summer casting, and see where Mello ended up with the Knicks or the Nets or out there in Denver where I'd like to be. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. This is Dr. Mark saying thank you so much for this time and your space. Be yourself and be well and travel light through the darkness. See you next Wednesday, 9 p.m. for more Soma Dad.
Oh, bless to be with you.
Spiral on, sapiens.